Gertrud Lauterbach is a German criminal detective in the city of Iserlohn, state of North Rhine-Westphalia. In the summer of 1972, her office delegates her to join the staff of the Olympic Games in Munich. At that time, she's 36 years old. She works as what is so called an Olympic hostess. Part of her duties is to walk inspection rounds through the Olympic Village. During the night from September 4th to September 5th, she has to work and takes on her light blue costume uniform.
My shift had already started the day before at 11 p.m.
11 p.m. Exactly the same time the terrorists in the Hotel Augsburg in Munich received their weapons. They got their last briefing. They meet in the hotel room number 12. We have talked about in our last episode within our podcast series Geheimakte 1972. 1 hour later, around midnight, Israeli fencer André Spitzer arrives in Munich, back from a short trip to the Netherlands where he met his wife Anki. He came by train, which he nearly missed in the Netherlands.
He did call at midnight, at 12 o'clock at night. You had only pay phones. So he said, I have only 2 marks, so we have to talk quickly. And I said, did you see all the others of your team? And he said, no, they went to a performance in Munich, Fiddler on the Roof, but I understand that they are coming back soon. And so we talked, and he said, I only have one fifth left. So he said, Anki, I love you, I'll call you tomorrow, and ta-ta-ta. And that was the last time I ever spoke to him. Because, indeed, the team came back an hour later at 1 o'clock in the morning. They sat around and they talked till 2 o'clock in the morning. And then everybody went to sleep. There were 5 different apartments in the Olympic Village next to each other. So everybody went to his apartment and went to sleep. And then at 4:30 in the morning, Palestinian terrorists came into the village and into the building of the Israelis.
To 2:30 in the morning, the terrorists in the Hotel Augsburg get ready to leave. Terrorist Sameer remembers when later interrogated by the German police.
It was about 2:30 when the first group, Tony's, left the hotel. The second group followed about 10 minutes later. We got into the cab, taking our bags with us into the car. Isa told the driver the destination in German. I didn't understand it. We then drove to the Olympic site.
Breaking up at 2:30, according to Sameer's memory. The other marked the time of her departure a bit later, around 3 o'clock. The taxi ride, then the walk to the gate of the Olympic area. It is around 4 p.m. when the bloody attack against the Israeli Olympic team begins.
Geheimakte 1972, das Olympia-Attentat in München.
Hallo Tunis, wir haben die israelische Mannschaft in unserer Gewalt.
My brother came to do sport in the Olympics and they were murdered there.
Die ganze Geschichte, investigativ recherchiert. Bisher unveröffentlichtes Material.
I was contacted by a German journalist, Christoph Lemmer.
Geheimakte 1972, die ganze Geschichte.
Hochwey September mehr allein, achadassar, kulam
Episode 6. Gertrud Lauterbach und der Überfall.
Welcome to the first out of 3 episodes about this day, September 5th, 1972. Sources for this episode are interrogation protocols, internal reports, planning sheets and timetables from within the police offices. This episode is being released at 4 o'clock on September 5th, 2022, exactly 50 years after the terrorists started to invade the area of the Olympic Village. First of their tasks there, assuring themselves that they reached the correct gate, the planners had providing them with the necessary detail.
There was a small hill and a tree. That was our meeting place. But the place where we then climbed over the fence was illuminated. There was a door set into the fence. Before we climbed over the fence, we watched for about 10 minutes or so, as not to arouse suspicion when we climbed over. There were 7 to 10 young men, maybe a girl among them, who then came and climbed over the door in the fence into the area of the Olympic Village. We waited for a while, and then we also crossed over.
But someone sees them, men working for the postal service on the way to their morning shift. The police failed to ask the witnesses timely, although they reported to their supervisor what they saw, and the supervisor calls the police immediately after. It was 6 o'clock in the evening. The assault was completely out of control when someone of the leading staff remembered that there were witnesses who saw the terrorists climb over the fence. This was the time when the employees of the postal service were interrogated first time. And this is what one of them, Heinz-Peter Gottelt, told them.
Usually we are 7 men being commuted by a bus at 3:40 in the morning from our dormitory to the Olympic Center. This was the case as well today, September 5th, 1972. Usually we are arriving there 5 to 10 minutes after 4 o'clock, should have been the same today. We then went over the Kohlemeinenweg in western direction and then turned right on the Kusuchinski Dam and then further to the entrance of the Olympic Center. We just wanted to get over the bridge that leads to this entrance. Two of us had already entered the bridge. I don't remember who. However, I then heard a noise from the right-hand side behind me. It came from the Olympic Village, originated by a gate in a fence that was locked up. When I looked at it, I saw people climbing over that gate. At first sight, they were 5 or 6 men. One of them did not climb over. He went away to the right side of the gate and then southbound behind a shrub at a little hill. This first group of 5 or 6 men had just finished climbing over when this man returned from behind the shrub, accompanied by another 5 or 6 men. These men then also climbed over the gate. The aforementioned man helped them as he did for the first group. He helped them by picking bags, light color, maybe white like sports bags. They were 50 to 60 centimeters long. When they climbed over, there was a rattling noise from the gate. It took a while until all of them were on the other side. I did not hear them talking. When I saw them, I was 35 to 40 meters away from them. It was not full daylighted yet, but also not fully dark anymore. I would describe it as dawn. So it was impossible to recognize further detail with the men. I can't say how they exactly looked like or what clothes they wore.
But the terrorists realize that someone looks at them. Terrorist Samir.
From outside the fence, someone was watching us. I think there were 3 men who even made some joking remark when we climbed over.
Which is the case, in fact. There were 3 postal employees, and one of them makes a joke about these men climbing over fence's gate. Another of these 3 testified.
I didn't really care about these men, so I didn't watch closer and don't remember details. But I was asking myself why they're entering the village that way and not through the main entrance. To me, they were sports people living in the village, coming home late. We were joking about how these guys probably wouldn't win any medals on the day. We were joking about how these guys probably wouldn't win any medals the following day.
After getting on the area, we went to the house where the Israelis lived. Issa went first. Tony with his group had already reached the house. When we entered, Issa went in first.
Tony's vanguard already had cleared the situation.
In the dormitory of the Israelis, the weapons were handed out. They were in a big bag. I assumed that Tony and his people smuggled in the bag in advance. They had entered 10 minutes earlier than we had.
In the house, there is a staircase. We took our weapons out of our pockets and made the weapons ready to fire. We loaded them through so that there was a bullet in the barrel.
At the same time, Gertrud Lauterbach finishes her break.
On Tuesday, September 5th, 1972, at around 4:45 a.m., I left our staff lounge along with the area manager for the Olympic Village to go on night patrol. Together with Mr. Ludwig, I went to the women's village for a patrol.
After entering the house where the Israeli men were accommodated, the terrorists have to orientate first. There is one information they received from their planners which turns out being false. An important one.
When we were all still together at the bottom of the stairs, Issa went up, without a bag and without a gun. And when he came back after 2 or 3 minutes, he said to Tony that the Israelis don't live on the fourth floor. People from Hong Kong live there. And then Tony went up, also without a gun and without a bag. And when he came back after about a minute, he said that the Israelis live upstairs on the second floor. Tony also said that the names of the Israelis are written on the doors.
File notice. On the wall at the eastern side, opposite to the elevator, there is another door to an apartment. In the upper third part of the door, the number 1 is written on, and underneath, a door viewer. On the right side of the door viewer, there are blue stickers with names on them as follows. Amisor Zafira, Moshe Weinberg, Andrei Spitzer, Kat Shoah, Tuvia Sokolsky.
After finding this out, Issa then assigned me and Abu Alala as posts and went up with the others.
One of these others is the terrorist Badran. Badran, as well as one of these 3 terrorists who survived and have been arrested and interrogated by the police. He testifies.
We were 4 and we went to the door with the number 1. We were Issa, Tony, myself, and another comrade. I don't quite remember. Maybe it was Darwish. Issa rang the doorbell several times. After a while, an Israeli opened the door, just a crack. When he saw us, he wanted to close the door again, immediately. But he couldn't because Issa placed his gun barrel into the gap.
It is Moshe Weinberg who braces himself against the door, a wrestler and wrestling referee at the Olympics.
We couldn't push the door open because this Israeli was a very strong wrestler and also could lean against the opposite wall. At the same time, he was shouting out something. A second came and helped keeping the door closed. Because of the noise, our comrades from the basement came running up and helped us pushing the door open. We didn't succeed, so Issa gave order. Shoot. Tony then shot through the door.
To be correct, it is a shot out of the gun whose barrel is sticking between door and door frame.
The shot injured the Israeli's cheek or neck. Now they let the door and we could enter the apartment, while Salmea remained in the basement as he was ordered to guard the house entrance. I watched the entrance on the ground floor. The other 6 of us were storming the apartment.
One of the Israelis escapes. Tuvia Sokolovsky, weightlifter's coach. He smashes a window and flees over the terrace. Here is how Sokolovsky remembers.
I was roused from sleep around 4 a.m. I jumped out of bed and ran into the apartment's lobby dressed in my pajama. I saw Mr. Gutfreund to lean against the apartment door, which someone from the outside was about to push open violently. The door was already open for a small gap against the doorframe. I saw a gun barrel through the gap. Mr. Gutfreund leaned against the intruder and shouted, "Friends, get away!" So I ran back into my room and opened the window. Mr. Springer closed our room door and blocked it by moving the bed against the door. At this moment, I heard a series of shootings. I heard a hard hit against the apartment door and a sudden cry. I couldn't identify who cried. I went outside through the opened window. There I met a German soldier wearing a beret on his head with a patch displaying a tank on it. I told the soldier that we had been assaulted. Together with him, we went to a room in which 2 Koreans were living. Since I was barefoot, I slipped into a pair of bathing slippers. The soldier picked up the phone and tried to call the police, but didn't get a connection. I was so excited that I don't remember further detail. In this apartment, I locked myself in the toilet for about an hour. Before I locked myself up in the toilet, I heard more shooting. The German soldier told me to remain in this apartment. He returned around 5 o'clock, identified himself, and then said it was all okay now. German police had arrived, but the Arabs had occupied the whole building and I shouldn't leave the apartment for the time being.
This uniformed soldier is named Raoul Leindecker. At that time, he is 20 years old, working as a waiter and doing army service. The army ordered him to the Olympic Games as a driver. He was on duty driving the team of the Bahamas. He just came back to the Olympic Village after bringing two delegates of the Bahamas team to the airport. Leindecker testifies.
I arrived in the Olympic Village around 4:15 in the morning and went into Knollystrasse number 21. I parked the car in the basement garage. Then I went to the building and rang the doorbell. I waited until the door was opened. At this moment, a smaller man came close, saying he was Israeli. He spoke broken German only. He repeatedly said, "Shooting! Shooting! My friend dead! Call police!" He asked me to follow him to the house in which the members of the Korean team were accommodated. He must have rang the doorbell there before because one of the doors stood open. On my request, I was allowed to pick up the phone and call the police. I told the officers what the Israeli said to me, that his friend was shot. The officer said he would go after my notice. Since the man didn't want to go with me, I left him in the house of the Koreans and went to the house numbered 31 alone. Here the door into the house was standing open as well. I went in, but when I came near to the apartment door next, a man with a machine gun came and shouted in English, "Stand still! Don't come in! Get out!" Since I didn't follow immediately, he twice pushed the gun's barrel into my stomach. And then I went out backwards and closed the house door after leaving.
Meanwhile in the Israeli apartment, one of the hostages, Moshe Weinberg, offers resistance against the intruders.
When I asked Abu Alala what had happened, he told me that the Israeli who was standing at the door of the apartment had been wounded by a shot and one had died. Abu Alala was holding Issa's machine gun at the time, in addition to his own. Inside the apartment, the Israeli attacked Abu Alala and he could not shoot because he was holding the two machine guns. The Israeli was then shot by someone else. Only later did I learn that it was in fact Darwish who had fired the shot at the Israeli.
All this noise steered the other sportsmen from sleep. One of them, the fencer Dan Alon.
There was already daylight when I awoke due to noise in the house. At first, I thought that the guys from Southern America living on the floor above us were making party. My teammate Yehuda woke up as well. We looked at each other and tried to continue sleeping. But some minutes later, I heard a shot that sounded as if fired above our apartment. But I could hardly believe that someone could have shot here, so I thought I was dreaming this.
But it's not a dream, it's real, and the shooting continues. It is to be heard on the outside as well. Gertrud Lauterbach, while patrolling the woman's village, hears it as well.
On the way to gate 29, we heard muffled gunshot-like sounds from the men's village at around 5:10 a.m. It may have been two volleys of 3 to 4 shots or 3 to 4 individual shots. At that moment, we weren't sure if they were actually gunshots. We then proceeded to gate 30 to enter the men's village. There at the gate, the connection point from the women's to the men's village, we asked the guard from the security service if he had made similar observations. He said no. Since he was sitting in a guardhouse behind a high apartment block, this is quite understandable. He did, however, say that he had overheard radio transmissions reporting a shooting in the vicinity of the DOZ building. We then proceeded to the Connolly Street, where we met the section leader of Group C, Mr. Müller. He asked us to go with him, since he had been told that there had been a shooting in the building at Connolly Street 31.
Meanwhile, at the basement door, terrorist Badran still holds his position there. He doesn't witness what's going on into the apartment number one.
After 3 minutes, Issa and Abu Alala left the apartment and said that they have met 7 Israelis inside. But one of them escaped backwards over the terrace. Issa said also that all hostages had been tied up except the one who was injured.
7 hostages only. Not enough. Issa, once more.
Issa asked the Israeli where the other Israelis have been accommodated. He promised the injured let go to a hospital if he showed us the way. Issa spoke in English to the Israelis. After this conversation, the Israeli guided us to the next doors.
The next Israeli apartment on their way was number 2. Issa wants to go in, but Weinberg allegedly tells him there were no Israelis in there, which was false. Why he so said, if he did, never has been cleared. Possibly he thought that his teammates from apartment number 3 were better able to fight the terrorists than those in number 2. In number 3, there were the wrestlers, fighters, who he coaches.
At this door, now Issa rang the bell. Someone looked down from a window in the first floor. He looked frightened when he saw his injured fellow citizen. His name was Mark.
This certain Mark. This is Mark Slavin. He is 18 years old and the youngest in the Israeli team. We learned about his life in the 4th episode of this podcast series. And the reason why Mark looks frightened is pretty obvious. His fellow citizen down there with his bleeding wounds is someone he knows very well. It's his own coach, Moshe Weinberg.
Issa spoke to the Israeli at the window in German language. Then another Israeli came to the house door and opened it. While we were standing in front of the house, we were hiding our machine guns aside or behind us. Now we intruded the apartment with arms in the ready. Abu Alala and myself remained downstairs with the wounded Israeli and the one who opened the door. Issa went up the rounded stairs on his own.
Shortly to explain, all of the apartments have 2 floors. There are stairs outside the apartments to get to the apartments. And there are rounded stairs within the apartments to get from the rooms on the floor to the rooms on the other.
He forced the Israelis in the upper floor to step down. They were 5 or 6. Now we were leading the captured Israelis and the injured back into the first house. Abu Alala went first, followed by the Israelis, then Issa and myself. Then the Israelis went down to the stairs, although no one had told them so. Issa shouted at them to come up again. But one or two took the chance and escaped through the basement level.
Another remark on the situation. The houses are built against the wall. The front door is on the first upper floor. The ground level is on the back side, which is the basement level with the parking lots. So what happened here? They entered the house through the front door and the hostages just went down the stairs to the basement level, which was their chance to escape.
One or two of them escaped through the basement to the parking lots. Samir didn't shoot after them.
A mistake the terrorists made. Samir testified that Issa criticized him for this.
Of these 7 Israelis, 3 came down to the basement stairs, past Abu Alala to my place. They were already at the door, and I thought that this was done on purpose from our side. Therefore, Abu Alala and I made no effort to stop these people. When the 3 Israelis were already at my place, Issa shouted to send the people back up. At the same time, one of the Israelis had already opened the door and went out into the open. I had my eyes on Abu Alala at that point, and this situation was taken advantage of by the Israeli, and he fled. I could have stepped out and shot after the Israeli, but I didn't do that because he was already outside. The other 2 Israelis went back upstairs alone, and then Issa led them away. Later, Issa wanted to know how it was possible for an Israeli to escape. I told him what happened, and he said that I have to be careful and that this should not happen again.
And just this moment, when it gets more difficult, policemen come closer.
Already when Issa and Abu Alala led the second group of Israelis into the apartment and when I watched the house entrance, suddenly a civilian came to the door. He had an Olympic symbol patched to the right pocket of his jacket.
This civilian is a policeman, as confirmed in a file notice.
Police Officer A tried to open the door into the house Connolly Street 31, Stairway 1, and step into the not illuminated stairway. After opening the door completely and looking inside, an unknown male with machine gun ready came closer and shouted, "Away!"
Which terrorist Badran describes from his perspective.
In his right hand, this man carried a pistol. He opened the door, firstly reached his hand with the pistol inside, and then walked a bit into the entrance hall. I assume he was a policeman because he was armed. At that time, I stood on the stairs and got my machine gun ready and called, "Out!" Then he left through the house entrance.
Meanwhile, the situation in the apartment becomes critical. The injured Moshe Weinberg attacks one of the terrorists and beats him. he catches a fruit knife and hits it against Issa. But he just cuts the breast pocket of his jacket, again shooting. Allegedly fired by Tony and Darwish, Moshe Weinberg collapses.
From my post at the entrance, I heard several gunshots. To my memory, it were three.
Gertrude Lauterbach reaches the house Connollystraße 31. All in all, it is less than an hour since terrorists climbed over the fence. The time now, around 5:20.
As we got closer to the house, I noticed that a window was opened on the upper floor of property number 31. A little later, a man whose face was painted with a dark color and who wore sunglasses and a light straw hat became visible behind it. He beckoned us over and also asked us to come closer. When we arrived just in front of the entrance, he called down to us in good, understandable German. Responding to our questions about what had happened, he said that shots had been fired and that we should call an ambulance. As my colleagues were discussing what to do, the man at the window became agitated and shouted down that someone should come to him to receive his demands. I then stood under the window and he lowered down one sheet of paper. However, since he still had other sheets in his hand, I asked him to throw down the rest of the sheets to me as well. After he had done this and I wanted to read what was written on it, I noticed that all four typewriter sheets were written in English. I then handed these sheets to a colleague and he handed me his walkie-talkie. The man at the window asked us to act quickly, as time was running out. Since I was now in possession of a walkie-talkie, the man turned to me and demanded that I finally call an ambulance. I followed his demand and ordered an ambulance. As my colleagues were still standing next to the entrance discussing what to do, the man at the window shouted at the men that they had to leave immediately, that he didn't want the police. He then closed the window, and a little later he appeared in the front door armed with a machine gun. Again, he demanded that we follow his demands and call for an ambulance as soon as possible. While he demanded that all the men disappear, which for him was not happening fast enough, he insisted that I stay with him.
This man who demands Gertrude Lauterbach to stay, this man is Issa, the leader. He then returns into the apartment.
4 minutes later or so, Issa and Abu Alala came to me at the entrance and said they wanted to get out the injured. Issa took a hand grenade in his hand and had his face painted black. Issa stayed at the entrance while me and Abu Alala went into the Israeli's apartment and in there the rounded stairs on the first floor. Both of us and my friend Abdel Kader carried the injured Israeli downstairs to the entrance. On our way, I realized that he was wounded at the stomach. He had his hand on the stomach. Abu Alala said he was hit there by a bullet. While we carried him, Abu Alala told me what happened. He said the injured Israeli jumped at him on the first floor, took his machine gun with both hands and tried to pull it away. Accidentally, he pulled the trigger and one or two shots were fired and hit another Israeli who was killed. Next, Darwish or Tony fired against the Israeli and hit him in the stomach.
This is what Badran says, but the police investigators don't believe all of it. This is how the interrogation goes on.
What Abu Alala told can't be true. The killed Israeli was hit by at least 7 bullets. There were also bullet holes in the wall next to where we found him. This indicates that he was not shot just by chance, but intentionally and focused.
I cannot say anything other since I have not been there and did not see it with my own eyes. Maybe there were more shots fired, but because of the fast bursts, I only heard 3. When we carried the injured one, this is what Abu Alala told me about this incident, just the way I told you.
When you carried this Israeli who got shot in the face, neck, stomach, was he still alive at this point in time?
When I went up there and picked him up, I thought he was dead. So I wanted to close his eyelids, which frightened him, moved, and made a noise.
And as if all this isn't enough, Issa still wants more.
Even before we had carried out the injured, Issa wanted us to take more Israelis from the other houses. I warned him and said the police was there. So he dropped his idea. When we arrived downstairs with the injured Israeli, we carried him outside of the building and laid him down on the floor. 2 men were coming right away with a stretcher who took him.
Same situation as testified by one of the officers who watched from the outside. including a macabre detail.
The leader then ordered his men to lay down the injured man on the pavement. The paramedics picked him up and carried him to the ambulance. There his death was detected. The paramedics refused to drive him away with the ambulance.
While all this happened, Gertrud Lauterbach holds her position at the entrance and continues talking to Issa.
He demanded of all the men present that they now leave for good. He literally ordered me to stay. He even wanted me to follow him into the house. I told him that I would be more useful if I stayed in front of the house because the walkie-talkie had a better connection and I could communicate quicker if he wishes something. He agreed with that. In the conversation that followed, the Arab told me that they had about 20 to 25 Israeli hostages who were tied up and would be shot if their demands were not met. I tried to calm him down. Between our conversations, he repeatedly went back into the house. I, however, remained next to the house, even if I moved back and forth from time to time. Here I noticed another man on the upper floor who was wearing a red sweater. This man was a lot younger, about 20 to 23 years old. He had black, curly hair, was without headgear, and his face was not painted. I noticed that he was also carrying a weapon. Further away, I could observe another man on the second floor in the open balcony door who was also carrying a machine gun. I can't describe this man in any detail because he never came out of the door. During a conversation with the man at the door, I was able to briefly look into the stairwell and I noticed another Arab sitting there on the stairs. He also had dark hair and was dressed in dark colors. I didn't notice any camouflage on him. At around 6:30, the mayor, Mr. Tröger, arrived. I saw him coming from a distance, went to meet him and briefly informed him about what had happened so far. After that conversation, Mr. Tröger left again.
Remark on Mayor Tröger. Gertrud Lauterbach means the head of the Olympic Executional Committee of Germany. He was partly kiddingly referred to as the mayor of the Olympic Village.
From time to time, the previous leader of the conversation kept appearing at the door telling me to join him. Once he asked me about the athletes living in the opposite block because they were all standing on their balconies watching the events. I told him that they were athletes from the GDR. He then said that they could follow their daily routines and go to the competitions because they had nothing against all athletes. When Mr. N appeared and explained to me that the police president, Dr. Schreiber, and the mayor, Mr. Tröger, wanted to negotiate with the spokesman, I called for him. After he had come to the door, Mr. N informed him that now the police commissioner, for whom he had already asked, and the mayor of the village were ready to negotiate. He agreed to negotiate with them, after which Mr. N left to get the men. The Palestinian disappeared back into the house.
The police diary notes, 6:05 a.m. Village Mayor Tröger appears on site.
After the men arrived, he came out again, but he had both hands behind his back. I could observe that he was holding an object in his hands, which I assumed was a grenade. After a short conversation about the ultimatum time, the men disappeared again. Now the spokesman beckoned me back. Because of his hand grenade, I approached him hesitantly and I asked him to put this thing away because I was scared. However, he kept the hand grenade with him. Now I told him that I really wasn't in a good situation because I didn't have any cigarettes with me and I had run out of candy. He then offered me a cigarette, which I accepted. Before handing me the lighter, he put his hand grenade in his jacket pocket. While we stood there, he gave me more cigarettes and once he also handed me a banana, but demanded the peel back so that his fingerprints could not be taken from it.
Seven o'clock in the Spitzer's family's house in the Netherlands.
The next morning at 7 o'clock, my parents came to my bedroom and they woke me up and they said to me, Anki, how many people are there in the Israeli delegation? I just opened my eyes. I said, I don't know. I think 20, 22, 25. I don't know how many. And they said, and who is the boxing coach? I said, there is no boxing coach because Israel did not send any boxers to the Olympics. But I said, why are you asking me this at 7 o'clock in the morning? So my father said, it is on the news now. There was an attack now at the apartments of the Israelis in the Olympic Village. And I said, and what happened to the boxing coach? Which I knew that there wasn't. And they said they already killed him and they put him in front of the building. And I jumped out of my bed and I said, there is no boxing coach, but maybe it is the fencing coach, maybe it is Andre. So I ran downstairs and we had those Olympic Games were the first time broadcast live. It was all live. So we had the TV on Dutch program, on the German program. We had the radio there and I never moved from that spot for 21 hours and just trying to watch and see. So I called immediately the Israeli ambassador in Holland and I said, if you're looking for me to tell me something in Israel, I'm not in Israel, I'm here in Holland. They said, we know that you are in Holland and we already sent security agents to the house of your parents and to the hospital. I said, how do you know where my parents live? And now they said, we know and they are on the way. And I said, and who are you sure that Andre is one of the hostages or maybe he escaped? He said, we don't know yet. At 9 o'clock in the morning, they called me and they said, Andre is one of the hostages.
Outside the building in Munich, Moshe Weinberg's body still lying on the pavement.
7:10 a.m. Police officer reports. Red Cross special arrived, asks if they may enter site.
Red Cross special. This is the transport to pick up the dead body.
7:16 a.m. Red Cross special arriving. 7:25. Red Cross special drives away with the dead Israeli. Transportation sheet completed by criminal detective K.
Meanwhile, Gertrud Lauterbach continues talking to Issa.
During another conversation, he asked me about my profession. I replied that he surely knew what profession I had. He then said that I must be working for the police. Asked about my duties, I said that I was currently on leave and did not perform any police duties here. Since he was now looking at me sharply, I explained to him that the female criminal investigators in Germany were mainly responsible for child and juvenile delinquency. With my explanation, I wanted to make clear to him that there was a difference between the tasks of the female criminal investigators in Germany to those in Palestine in order to counter his suspicion. He now came to talk about morality in Germany and expressed the opinion that it had fallen very low among young people. Every time he came out of the house again, he assured himself of every change on the Connolly Street. He told me that he feared the police might launch an attack on the house at any given moment. In case of such an eventuality, he advised me to then move away as quickly as possible. At first, there was only one man from the law enforcement agency in sight, whom he accepted. However, when several people in civilian clothes were gathered around this man, he became very nervous and said that these were not athletes, even though I tried to calm him down. He then asked me to make sure that these people would disappear, because otherwise he would have to become violent, because he didn't want any police in the vicinity. Every now and then, the Arab would walk up to the corner of the house and look into the driveway to see what was going on around the corner. While doing that, he noticed a man standing in the doorway to the exit. That man stepped back when he saw the Arab, but he was visible through the glass door. After noticing this, the Arab told me to go up to the man and ask him to leave, because otherwise it would cost him his head. He said that he was certain that this man was from the police because he had been standing there for a long time. I complied with the order and the police officer also withdrew. On this occasion, I told the sportsmen living there who were standing on their balconies and around their apartments that they could move freely. Around 8:25 a.m., my colleague Mrs. Gries took over for me. I introduced her to the Arab and told him that she would now stay with him instead of me. He agreed because I had already negotiated this with him beforehand. He also agreed to a further discussion with the chief of police and the mayor.
In the family Spitzer's house, the telephone rings. It's the embassy of Israel in the Netherlands.
At 9 o'clock in the morning, they called me and they said, Andre is one of the hostages.
Same time in Israel.
My parents knew that Mark is about his first wrestling fight. It's on the 5th of September at 10 o'clock in the morning.
8:28 a.m. 20 men reinforcement arriving on site.
war of nerves begins. Continued with the next episode.
Geheimakte 1972. 50 Jahre nach dem Olympia-Attentat in München. Ein Podcast der Antenne Bayern Group.
You like this podcast? Consider writing a review, sharing it with your friends or clicking like or full 5 stars. You feel you have something to contribute? Contact me via email to geheimakte@antenne.de.